I think for a lot of people, there is a love-to-hate Washington, D.C. attitude. While many may view the seat of American power as tragically polarized, Chief National Correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, Mark Leibovich, believes that Washington perhaps isn't polarized at all. In his new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital, Leibovich delivers very witty and often stinging portraits of the people who make up the nation's media industrial complex, the people who both derisively and smugly call Washington this town, which of course is the title of his book. His account is packed with such famous names from the Obamas and the Clintons to Harry Reid, Susan Rice, Colin Powell, Haley Barbour, David Axelrod, Joe Biden, Paul Ryan, Joe Scarborough, David Gregory, Andrea Mitchell, and many others. It's a great pleasure to welcome perhaps the most famous name of them all, Mark Leibovich, to the program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Famous or infamous. Hi, Joe. It's good to be here.
So when you write a book about Washington, I mean, there is that buzz that comes in where everybody wants to know, you know, if they're in it, if they're not in it. If they're in it, they may get mad. If they're not in it, they may get mad. So yeah. I assume you've been living that for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, I sure have been. I mean, it's been a bizarre few weeks. I mean, I've written this book, and it's been the source of a lot of anticipation for, you know, many months, and people have been speculating who's going to win, who's going to lose, who's going to get trashed, and what have you. And I think ultimately what's so great now is that people actually have a book to read, and people seem to be liking it, and people seem to be both entertained and also outraged by it. So I guess that's a good thing. And look, if it shakes things up here, all the better.
So what does that say about the city itself that something like this, a book about the city, somebody's going to write about us, that shakes it up so?
Well, I mean, Washington is absolutely obsessed with Washington, and especially the media. I mean, Washington, I say, puts the me in media, right? And look, it's a very self-absorbed place, and it's a city that has taken very, very good care of itself. I mean, if you look at the local economy, which has become, you know, by far, this has become the wealthiest metropolitan area in the country, in part because of money that the government can print for itself. I mean, whether in the form of government contracting or in the form of government itself, in the form of any number of derivative industries. So, look, and this book kind of came from an awareness that the city had reached a tipping point of self-celebration at a time when the rest of the country was holding the city in very, very, very low regard. So, in a sense, this book came out of that disconnect.
The book opens at the funeral of Tim Russert. And as you point out in the book, that this obviously is a very sad time, and he died unexpectedly, and there was great respect for him, within the city, but at this funeral, it becomes like it's network central. It's everyone.
Yeah, it's true. It became a cocktail party before it was even a cocktail party. No, it's true. I mean, that was sort of the first scene of the book, like you said. I mean, I was just sitting there and just amazed at how this somber, supposedly somber occasion just was given over to networking, and everyone was working it and throwing business cards around and trying to get each other booked on their shows and congratulating someone or trying to suck up to the hottest politician or the hottest operative of the moment. And I just thought that was such a powerful scene. I mean, first of all, it was like a state funeral. I mean, everyone was there. Presidents, former presidents, you know, the nominees of the two parties at the time, Barack Obama and John McCain, you know, first ladies, and it was just an amazing pageant. But I think so that chapter was an opportunity to introduce a lot of the characters who would be appearing throughout the book, but also to really undress the scene and sort of undress, frankly, the horror of what so much of the city has become.
One of the things you point out in the book is that so many administrations come in and say they're going to change Washington, they are going to change it, they are going to clean it up, they are going to take away the lobbyists, and they're going to make it a more pure place. Your most recent example, of course, is the Obamas coming to Washington, and that claim was certainly made by the administration, referring to it as Suck Up City. And as you point out, it still is pretty much what it was, you know, 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the case study that I sort of jumped on, because it's been consistent throughout the 5-year chronology that I'm writing on, is just the Obama experience and how they themselves, in large part, have been sucked up city, and by how, you know, change and hope and just not buying into the traditional Washington way of doing things was a very, very effective marketing strategy in 2008. But in fact, that's kind of all it was. I mean, the president himself has said that he has not changed Washington. It was one of his biggest failures, although it's unclear to me how hard they really tried. But essentially, yeah, I mean, the question, you know, did we change Washington or did Washington change us? I mean, I think, which is something that they asked themselves, I think has been answered pretty eloquently.
And his disdain for it, his thought that it was, I think you point out in the book, of not just distasteful but rather pathetic, comes also, as you point out, that 2009 was the most profitable year ever for the profession of lobbyists.
Sure.
$3.4 billion, almost 3.5. Spent on lobbying.
Yeah, no, it was one of the most, I think, the most successful year ever in lobbying, and this despite the fact that the vehemently or supposedly vehemently anti-lobbying Obama campaign had come into the White House. So, yeah, look, I mean, I think one of the things that you see in Washington is whenever there is complication in the government, and obviously Barack Obama had a very, very ambitious agenda, and certainly healthcare. The healthcare overhaul was a huge, you know, legislative thing, policy thing, but also a big lobbying bounty in 2009. And that is kind of what you see, right? I mean, the more government grows, the more machinations that go on, you know, even in the fine print, I mean, the more people and industries are going to grow up and do very, very well around that. So, yeah, I mean, I think also, though, that the vow not to have lobbyists in the White House, which, of course, has been relaxed many times now, you know, didn't really do much, obviously.
And then, of course, there is you, 2 points to make regarding before we move on to other issues. But looking at lobbyists, one of them I found interesting is that you report 50% of former senators, 42% of congressmen become lobbyists.
Yeah, and I think that compares to about 2 or 3% back in the 70s. So, I mean, the revolving door is just spinning really, really smoothly for these people. And look, what's notable is that a lot of politicians go home to run for re-election or run for re-election somewhere in Missouri or Michigan or wherever, and they run against Washington as this swamp, and we're going to drain the swamp, and then they get here, and they settle into the place like a warm bath. And it's kind of sad because that's sort of the two-step that happens. And I don't know if they actually meant that they hate Washington, but a lot of them wind up staying here. And you do sort of wonder, even when they're in office, I mean, who are they working for? Are they working for their next job? Are they trying to impress, you know, prospective employers? Or are they actually doing the work that they were elected to do?
As you say in the book, punditry has replaced reporting as journalism's highest calling, accompanied by a mad dash of self-branding.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's all true. I mean, I'm. Look, maybe I speak from jealousy because I'm a print hack, right? And I don't have the head of hair to get on television a lot. No, I don't know if that's true. Well, I don't have a head of hair at all. You can't see me, but
I see the author photo. Yes.
Yeah, there's the author photo, but no, I mean, yeah, I mean, punditry is the gold standard now. I mean, that's where people want to be. People want to be on TV. They want to be spouting opinions. They want to get noticed, and I guess that's just sort of the game today, but I think that it comes at the expense of a lot of the reflective and really rigorous reporting that theoretically should be the most valued part of what we do as journalists.
So let me ask the obvious, naive, stupid question from the Rube, which is, when so much of the attitude outside of Washington is negative, why do you think that all of the factors that could potentially make it negative just seem to increase?
It's interesting. I mean, I think it's a combination of inertia. It's a combination of there just not being a lot of motivation to change from inside D.C., and frankly, the country allows it. I mean, the country is outraged, and yet, you know, a lot of the same congressmen of both parties keep getting returned to office. There's no punishment for lying. There's no punishment for people changing their mind and deciding, oh, well, by the way, maybe I'll stay in Washington and be a lobbyist rather than go home to the farm after, as I promised a few years ago. I mean, look, there's no fine for it. But what it does, and I guess this is probably the bigger psychic cost, is it wears you down. It wears the electorate down. It wears people like me down. And that itself, I think, is a huge psychic toll, and I think maybe over the long run, people pay a price. But I think right now, one of the messages of this book is that you will always eat lunch in this town again, and it's a very, very fat and happy time. And frankly, I'm disgusted by it, and I live here, and I am an insider, and I sort of look forward to hopefully making people uncomfortable by holding a mirror to this culture.
It seems, and we spent the first, almost the entire first hour of this program talking about Anthony Weiner.
Yep.
So I don't know, and how do you avoid that? And I don't know that you can.
No, it's a big story. It's a fascinating story. I mean, I get that.
I get it too. But it almost seems that there may be some jealousy in Washington that, oh, it moved to New York.
Yeah, although, you know, of course, Anthony Weiner, you know, I guess. It's sort of he first got in trouble in Washington. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Well,
as did Spitzer.
As did Elliot Spitzer.
Sure.
Yes. We take it as our own national scandal. I think the amazing thing about this book is that, or about promoting this book, is just that the point keeps getting proven over and over again, even as I tried to go out and talk about it. It's a case of vanity feeding on itself. I mean, Anthony Weiner, I mean, that story just keeps getting, actually it doesn't get crazier. I mean, it's actually somewhat predictable at this point. But look, I mean, I think the bottom line for Anthony Weiner right now is, well, I would say the bottom line is, you know, getting his life together. But ultimately, I mean, fame itself becomes the be-all and end-all, and even if he doesn't become mayor of New York, I mean, he'll, I'm sure, have a great book deal. He'll probably have big speaking deals, and I mean, not to be cynical here, but I mean, you do kind of acquire this neutral sheen of notoriety once you've been through the public ringer, even whether it's a good ringer or whether it's a good experience or what he's going through. But I don't know. I mean, it all tends to play itself out in real time.
So you have somebody like Mark Sanford who, okay, has a scandal, then is reelected to political office, is elected to another political office.
Right.
And instead of thinking that, oh, here comes a guy who's in embroiled in a scandal, he becomes kind of the flavor of the month.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's true. I mean, for every case is different, and you know, forgiveness and you know, the whims of the electorate are going to, you know, be in the eye of the beholder. But no, I mean, yeah, I think this actually kind of gets to the little joke at the beginning of the show. I mean, but I think fame and infamy are very, very close cousins these days. And I think, you know, once you have a brand, that itself becomes the be-all and end-all. And I think that's one of the messages of this town also.
And how much of it do you think spills out to politics as a whole, mm-hmm. of what is accepted in Washington that perhaps is not accepted elsewhere in the country?
I think that obviously Washington is a microcosm of the country, and in some ways it's a reflection of the country, and its many virtues of the country exaggerated into a small geographic area that happens to be bedecked by monuments and history and a lot of tourists and you know, a lot of the headiness that you see around here. But I think that this book was really geared to people outside the Beltway,
yeah.
because I do think that, I mean, this was a city that supposedly was different. This was a city that supposedly was built on public service. And sure, power is appealing, and influence is obviously going to appeal to people's egos, but this was supposedly the city that was not built on make-believe like Hollywood was, or you know, quick riches like Vegas was, or you know, just the Big Apple, or any number of sort of iconic American cities. this was supposed to be different, and in fact, I think this has been given over to some, I think, more base and frankly, greedier impulses in the last couple of decades.
Mark Leibovich's new book is This Town. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Mark, thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I really enjoyed the book. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.